Okay. Over to you.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this 74th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. Okay, this month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott accompanies Charles Leadbeater to Sri Lanka. So could we get a reader, please?
I'll start off today.
Okay.
Sunday, 11th April, being the Sinhalese New Year's Day, Leadbeater and I and others went to Kalani Temple, a very sacred shrine, a few miles from Colombo, to offer flowers and address the multitude. It was an animated scene indeed. What with the crowds of worshipers, the flower offerings before the images of Lord Buddha, the babble of chattering voices, the drawling intonations of the five precepts by the priests, and the full roar of repetitions by the people, the thousands of little lamps lit around the bow trees, gagabas, and the buildings, and the general stir and bustle. Buddhist worship is simplicity itself. The pilgrim carrying flowers of the lotus, lily, champak, and other sweet-smelling plants and trees doffs his sandals in the threshold of the house of statues, holds his joined palms to his forehead, lays the flowers on a marble slab before the image, bends his body reverentially, pronounces a phrase or two of the sacred teachings, and then quietly retires to give place to the next comer. That is all. And what could be simpler or more unobjectionable?
Thank you, BL. So a reader for this, please.
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
The image is not worshipped. The devotee offers his fragrant blooms to the ideal of the world savior, Gautama Buddha, whom he professes to follow in the eightfold path, Ayastanga Marga, which he traced out for all men, and whom he holds enshrined in his heart of hearts. The Buddhist monk is no mediator. His prayers can do nobody good save himself, and then only as practically worked into his daily life, thought, and conversation. The Tathagata was a man who, through countless rebirths, had at last reached the goal of wisdom and divine powers, and who had preached the doctrine that nirvana was attainable by all men who would profit by his discoveries and walk in the path of good and wise men.
Thank you, Yvonne. And last page.
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
No infallibility had he claimed, no dogma enforced or assumed authority of divine inspiration. He had taught in the Kalama Sutta, on the contrary, as I have above noted, that one should believe nothing taught by a sage, written in a book, handed down by tradition, or supposedly proved by analogy, unless the thing taught was supported by human experience. Full of compassion for all beings, moved to heartbreaking by the volume of human woe, he had voluntarily taken rebirth after rebirth to learn more and more, develop more and more his insight, and gradually fit himself to be the leader of ignorant mankind out of the quagmire of ignorance onto the firm ground of truth. One has only to mix with such a crowd as we saw at Kelanye to realize how deep is the devotion and love for the Buddha in the hearts of his followers.
Thank you, Vivian. Yeah, this teaching that the Buddha gave, where he says that one should believe nothing taught by a sage, written in a book, handed down by tradition, or supposedly proved by analogy, unless the thing taught was supported by human experience. That's the quote of that Buddha saying is in the front of every one of the blue books by Alice Bailey. Okay, so last time we finished the interim chapter that we'd spent about a year on globes, rounds, and the transference of the monadic life wave, then returned to a study of the stanzas, taking up verse 5 of stanza 6, which states, at the fourth round or revolution of life and being around the seven smaller wheels, the sons are told to create their images. One third refuses, two thirds obey. So moving from verse 4 to this verse 5 marks a turning point in the nature of the stanzas, which from now on focuses on human development in the fourth round. HPB says, between this shloka and the last, shloka 4, in this same stanza, shloka is a verse, extend long ages, and there now gleams the dawn and sunrise of another eon. We then learn that, quote, as the solid earth began by being a ball of liquid fire, of fiery dust and its protoplasmic phantom, so did man. Since both began as liquid fire, humanity is inextricably linked with the elemental evolution of the globe on which it finds itself. But the development of humanity is not incidental to the development of the globe, as modern science teaches, but is in fact the main purpose for that development. The globe develops in order to advance the development of humanity. We then learned that because we are on the fourth globe of the fourth round of the fourth chain, we are currently at the, quote, middle point of which the perfect equilibrium between spirit and matter had to take place. We then read a passage from a treatise on cosmic fire that further elucidates this midway point, revealing that in addition to being on the fourth globe, root race, and chain, the earth is the fourth scheme, and our solar system is the fourth of the fourth order, thus creating a, quote, simultaneous alignment, which results in the clearing of a channel direct from the heart of our scheme through every ring pass knot to the cosmic correspondence found outside the solar system altogether. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll begin this session by taking a look at the footnote referenced by the phrase, the middle point of which the perfect equilibrium being spirit and matter had to take place. Can we get a reader for the footnote, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please?
You there, Magda?
I see you unmuted, but we can't hear you.
I heard a very faint voice. You might try turning on your mic, turning it on and off or something. Well, looks like we have to move on. You might want to try to work out your audio problem so we can hear you for a read down the line a little bit.
Okay, Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, it was, as we shall see, at this period, during the highest point of civilization and knowledge, There's also of human intellectuality of the fourth Atlantean race that, owing to the final crisis of physiological spiritual adjustment of the races, humanity branched off into two diametrically opposite paths, the right and the left hand paths of knowledge or vidya. Thus were the germs of the white and the black magic sown in those days. The seeds lay latent for some time to sprout only during the early period of the fifth our race.
Thank you. Okay, so the Dark Brotherhood, which came into being or gained power during the Atlantean times, took advantage of the fact that Atlantis, being the fourth root race on the fourth globe, on the fourth round of the fourth chain, represented the point of maximum density for the entire Earth scheme, of the deepest immersion in matter. Whereas Ceres on the right-hand path took advantage of the equilibrium caused by reaching this midway point of the entire Earth scheme, which thus allowed humanity to confront its collective dweller on the threshold. Indeed, the midway point is that threshold. But the real battleground takes place during the fifth root race on the plane of Manas, at the midway point between higher and lower mind, represented by the fourth subplane of the mental plane. Because of the lack of developed mind in Atlantean times, the battle could only be won through hierarchical intervention, leading to humanity's near extinction by means of the flood that ended the fourth root race. That is, except for a relatively small group who migrated from the ruins of Atlantis to Central America, England, and the countries, especially the countries bordering the Mediterranean. Egypt was premier as being one of the places where the Atlanteans migrated to, in order to establish the fifth root race. The Atlantean midway point, which marked the beginning of the evolutional cycle, also allowed the hierarchy to begin the process of initiation. This is one of the aspects of the evolutionary cycle, that during involution, all attention is turned to the form aspect. But at this midway point, where the evolutionary urge takes hold, then one of the aspects that promotes that evolutionary urge is initiation. And that began as a result of the Atlantean experience. Okay, next. And by the way, you know, I thrive on interruptions, questions and answers, comments. You know, it's always more interesting to have a dialogue than to have a monologue. So jump in whenever you have something to say, or if you have a question about anything. So next up, says the commentary explaining the verse, the holy youths, the gods, refuse to multiply and create species after their likeness, after their kind. They are not fit forms, rupas, for us. They have to grow. They refuse to enter the chahayas, shadows or images of their inferiors. Thus had selfish feeling prevailed from the beginning, even among the gods, and they fell under the eye of the karmic Lipikas. Kind of an extraordinary teaching, this. So this old commentary specifically refers to the first half of the third root race, when the physical form of humanity had been successfully created by the lunar lords, who had not yet been endowed with mind. Right, that's humanity, not the lunar lord. So humanity had not yet been endowed with mind. They had been projected into being on the lower subplanes of the physical plane, physical, astral, and mental planes by the lunar lords, but had not yet been endowed with mind. The quote-unquote holy youths are the Manasaputras, who, we're told here, determined that the human forms were not yet fit vehicles for the gift of Manas, and thus refused to overshadow them or enter into them. The old commentary then characterizes this refusal as selfish feeling, which brought this group, quote, under the eye of the karmic Lupikas. For me, this begs the question, can Manasaputras, who have left behind all aspects of personality influence eons earlier, I mean, that's the very nature of these great fire beings, really have selfish feelings? Such an accusation seems to defy the very nature of these decentralized, group conscious beings. Or is this some kind of blind, which is, to my mind, a much more likely scenario? I see a hand.
Yes. Yvonne, please go ahead.
Francis, are Manasaputras the same as solar angels?
Yes. It's just another name. And it's in order to accentuate the word Manas. So, yeah, but they are essentially the same as solar angels. So, you know, it's a very interesting teaching. You know, solar angels with selfish feelings. I see another hand.
Go ahead, please, Scott.
Yeah, I wonder if that isn't the limitations of English and how you could explain it. I'm with you on the feeling part of it, but maybe from our point of view, it seems like it's a feeling, but it can't be from theirs.
Yeah, you know, it could mean something like inclination.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's, but feeling is, strikes us in English as with more power and more,
right. Well, you know, even more telling is the word selfish. You know, I mean, what do we do with that one? You know, that's why I say it just makes no sense. Unless the nature of Manasaputras have changed radically since, you know, the time of the third root race, I doubt it. You know, these people have been to Sirius to train in order to be solar angels. I would imagine that it is a blind of some type, suggesting something else. And there's a lot more teaching on this coming up about why they refuse to create that kind of belies this description. Okay, hands?
Yes. Mariana, go ahead, please.
This is such a fascinating part for me. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. One is which, could it not be a teaching about the fact that the higher respects the free will of the lower, even if it's misguided? You know, it's like a teaching about that. And how does it relate to these predictions of what happened with the destruction of Atlantis? It seems so relevant today, and I just wondered about those two things.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's really good point about the free will aspect. That's one of the themes that permeates his teaching on those who refused, and she gets into a more specific description of the purpose behind of refusing, and much later in the Secret Doctrine, and I bring that forward, and it does help explain that aspect of it. But your point is well taken, that we're looking at the free will to refuse. You know, there was, what's refused, by the way, is not the personal directive of some god, but the overall law of involution, which was to move into the material realms In order to inhabit the lower regions, you know, that's the whole first half of the cycle. And that's what's quote unquote refused, not some specific directive made by a personal god. So, yeah, thanks for your question. Next.
Okay, we have two hands up. Scott, I had put your hand down. Did you put it back up again? No. Okay. Vivian, please go ahead.
I think in all the Abrahamic religions and the ones that, you know, I've come across, they always talk about the fallen angels.
Yeah. Yes.
It's the basis of their religion in a way. So it's very much part of our psyche.
That is this subject, couched in the language of, you know, both, you know, of the, of both testaments, really. She deals with that, talks about Michael and Lucifer and how they were, you know, on, you know, opposing sides, but not really. And so we'll get into that. But yeah, that is what we're talking about, is this idea of the fallen angels. And I'll just say this much about it. It's too tempting to not address it in some way, that first of all, for Manasaputras or solar angels, the word fallen, which applies to all of them, is about the fact that they incarnate, right? That they compel the personality of which they are part of, right? Remember that fourth hierarchy, I mean, that fifth hierarchy is both personality and soul. There's an inextricable intertwining. So there is a literal fall that is sacrificed, a great sacrifice by the solar angels that they undergo. That's one aspect of the fallen quality, which is absolutely diametric to what the church teaches, which, you know, talks of the fallen. I'll be getting into this, of, you know, of Adam and Eve because they ate the apple, and therefore fall into sin, right? Well, there's a lot more to say about that, but we'll wait until it comes up. So yeah, next up, next question.
Ariana had her hand up again. Did you have another question or?
Well, it's just related to that. I think that this idea of the fallen angels, that's us. That is the fact that these beings took on a physical form, and that when the church uses this idea of fallen angels, they're actually talking about the planet itself and all the beings that sacrifice themselves on the planet. And from what I understood, Lucifer is the name of another name. I don't know if it's for Sanat Kumara, but another name for our planet. And so, yeah, this is the kind of thing where the church uses concrete forms and creates tremendous fear and guilt in the people who don't obey, you know, that they don't understand that the will be relinquished to the Father, to the being that ensouls this planet as one attains will. We're so far from even having will, we have self-will and we have desire. But so they talk about things out of sync, and then they threaten people so they're afraid even to die.
Well said. Well said. That's exactly right. It's a true perversion of the real teaching, right? Which is that, you know, they couch it in moral terms, you know. Hell is the, you know, it's the lower planes of existence. It's, you know, we are in that lower quaternary, which is the hell of Christianity, literally. You know, the way they portrayed hell is more like the lower astral planes, you know. But there's this great tragedy of a travesty of a mistake that the church promulgates, which is, you know, the idea that you have Satan as the representative of evil on one pole. So, and then of course, God as good on the other, when in fact, the truth of it is that one represents the material pole. You know, DK says over and over that so-called evil is really the aggrandizement of the material, right? And that the good is the move towards the spiritual. But really, the idea of good and bad is such a narrow human-oriented focus that is far superseded by the truth. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that much more as we move into the material. Next question.
Okay, James, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking of Lucifer, which means light bearer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the church's version, but does the more accurate version center in, did Lucifer want some kind of individualized power for himself, or was it really just following the will of spirit to incarnate? And I know we'll get into that later more.
Well, I'll just very briefly, it's bringing the fire of mind to humanity. And that's only done through the Manasa Putras and thus with the great sacrifice of that group, which Lucifer represents. So it's the Promethean myth, you know, where he tried to bring fire to humanity and Zeus tied him to a rock and he's gets his liver pecked out for, you know, a few eons. All that represents incarnation, you know, to be tied to a rock is to be forced to be on the physical plane, you know, with all the suffering that comes with that. Okay, more questions.
Yes, Yvonne, please go ahead.
As far as those two-thirds that refuse to incarnate to physical forms, wasn't it because it wasn't that they couldn't because the forms weren't adequate?
Yes, and that forms the subject of what we're going to be getting into big time. And it's one-third. It's one-third that, quote-unquote, refuses. And that's a higher group of beings who are literally unable to incarnate. And you know, actually for this webinar and the next, at least, we'll be exploring this theme a lot. HPB takes us into the Gnostic teaching, which really highlights this scenario that we're looking at right now. And it has its own cast of characters. It's quite interesting, really.
Yeah, so, that's great, because this is such a confusing subject.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. Well, mainly because of all the blinds and reversals that have been thrown at us. You know, I mean, it's not just Christianity. You know, there's been a lot of, like I mentioned a little later, that Typhon, who's the evil incarnation in Greece and in Egypt, initially was recognized as the great unseen force behind deity, you know, and so the darkness that is the source of light was degraded in popular spiritual belief to become the darkness that is the darkness of evil, you know, and it's you find that in a few cultures, but nobody puts as much top spin on that idea as Christianity. They really embraced that that idea of the fall. Anybody else?
I think we've got it for right this second.
How about that? Okay. We're then told that they had to suffer for it in later births. We're talking about the Manasa Putras here, who, you know, succumbed to selfish feelings, evidently, and so they had to suffer for it in later births. How this punishment reached the gods will be seen in the second volume. Okay, possibly this suffering took the form of having to deal with the half-man, half-animal anthropoids that these Manasaputras were indirectly responsible for because of their refusal. Remember reading about this? This is, you know, in that interim chapter, she introduced this idea that animal man, before it developed mind, mated with these great quote unquote she beasts of the time. And there was this kind of in half man, half animal creation that occurred called, that she calls anthropoids. So, you know, since that happened because indirectly because the Manasaputras did not overshadow the third root race at an earlier point, then they might be indirectly responsible for that. And that could be what's suggested here, where it says that they had to suffer in later births. And this, yes, I see a hand.
Is
Please
that
go ahead,
related,
Jane.
Is yeah. that related to the centaurs or Sagittarius?
No, not directly. Okay. There's the centaur Sagittarius represents animal man, right? Which is the third root race before they were overshadowed by the Manasaputras. Right. And of course, it's also a very particular symbol, which is represents a component of the really fourfold Sagittarian symbol. Right. So it's not quite the same, but it is related in that sense that it is that strange combination of man and beast represents animal man. Okay, this concludes HPB's commentary on verse 5. So, just as we did before the interim chapter, we'll now take a look at the verse itself. First, at the fourth round, or revolution of life and being around the seven smaller wheels, the second smaller wheels are the glow. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. So the literal verse just read at the fourth. This part of it just read at the fourth. And then her commentary informed her that what was being described in this verse is the round revolution of life and being around the seven smaller wheels, which, right? So the seven smaller wheels are the globes of a chain. Around is the sequential passage of the life wave through these seven globes. Thus, rounds are functions of time. They don't physically exist in and of themselves, as do just like hours and minutes of the day. Whereas chains and globes are literally physical events. So you could say chains are the expression, the greater expression that then sequentially takes place through the globes by means of the rounds. However, these rounds do greatly modify the way in which the globe function in accordance with how the life wave and where the life wave is at in its development as it sequentially passes through them. So, you know, we've talked a lot about this at this point. So hopefully you're starting to get a sense of how they, how these different terms interrelate. Yes, I see his hand.
Please just go ahead again, James.
Hey, wait
to
be
let you know, I don't have a clue about rounds, chains, globes, spheres,
yeah.
those schemes.
You must, I think you started a little later. We've been talking about this for months and months and months. I think if you hang in there, you'll eventually get a sense of it because it's a topic that never is far from being described, you know, in the teachings. So the next time it comes up, I'll lean into it a little bit, and eventually you'll get some sense of it. But it's not an instant thing. It does take a while to grasp. Okay. So the second half of this short little verse is, the sons are told to create their images. One third refuses, two thirds obey. It is this line that the old commentary that we just looked at addresses about the holy youths, right? Let's take a look at a passage in volume two that chronicles the whole story. So could we get a reader, please?
James, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. After the earth had been made ready by the lower and more material powers, and its three kingdoms fairly started on their way to be fruitful and multiply, the higher powers, the archangels or Dianas, sorry, Dionys, were compelled by the evolutionary law to descend on earth in order to construct the crown of its evolution, man. Thus, the self-created and the self-existent projected their pale shadows, but group the third, the fire angels, rebelled and refused to join their fellow devas. Hindu exotericism represents them all as yogins whose piety inspired them to refuse creating, as they desired to remain eternally kumaras, virgin youths, in order to, if possible, anticipate their fellows in progress towards nirvana, the final liberation. But agreeably to esoteric interpretation, refusing to create was actually a self-sacrifice for the benefit of mankind. The rebels would not create will-less, irresponsible men as the obedient angels did, nor could they endow human beings with only the temporary reflections of their own attributes, for even the latter, belonging to another and a so much higher plane of consciousness, would leave man still irresponsible, hence interfere with any possibility of a higher progress. No spiritual and psychic evolution is possible on earth, the lowest and most material plane, for one who, on that plane, at all events, is inherently perfect and cannot accumulate either merit or demerit.
Thanks, James. So, any thoughts or questions about this passage? So, here we have a much more satisfactory explanation for why the Manasaputras refused to overshadow animal man of the early third root race. Quote, but agreeably to esoteric interpretation, refusing to create was actually a self-sacrifice for the benefit of mankind. The rebels would not create will-less, irresponsible men as the obedient angels did, nor could they endow human beings with only the temporary reflections of their own attributes. For even the latter, belonging to another and a so much higher plane of consciousness, would leave man still irresponsible, hence interfere with any possibility of higher progress. So all this suggests that consciousness can't be blithely bestowed, but it must be worked for and you know, over a very long period, gradually earned, right? Any thoughts, questions about this? Okay, the passage continues. This is from the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. Reader, please.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Here we go. Thank you very much. Man, remaining the pale shadow of the inert, immutable, and motionless perfection, the one negative and passive attribute of the real, I am that I am, would have been doomed to pass through life on earth as in a heavy, dreamless sleep. Hence, a failure on this plane.
I'm going to interrupt, Martha. What he's referring to here is if the higher forces that refused would have engaged in man, engaged with man, this would have been the result. What you just read would have been the result. So go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Francis. Interrupt away. The beings, or the being collectively called Elohim, who first, if ever, pronounced the cruel words, quote, "Behold, the man has become as one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever," quote, must have been indeed the Lida
Ilde Baoth.
Thank you, Ilde Baoth, the demiurge of the Nazarenes, filled with rage and envy against his own creature, whose reflection created Ophiomorphos. In this case, it is but natural, even from the dead letter standpoint, to view Satan, the serpent of Genesis, as the real creator and benefactor, the father of spiritual mankind. For it is he who was the harbinger of light, bright, radiant Lucifer, who opened the eyes of the automaton creator, of the automaton created by Jehovah, as alleged. And he who was the first to whisper, "In the day ye eat, thereof ye shall be as Elohim, knowing good and evil," can only be regarded in the light of a savior, an adversary to Jehovah, the personating spirit. He still remains in esoteric truth, the ever-loving messenger, the angel, the seraphim and cherubim, who both knew well and loved still more, and who conferred on us spiritual instead of physical immortality. The latter, a kind of static immortality that would have transformed man into an undying, quote, wandering Jew, unquote.
Thank you, Martha. Somehow so appropriate that you read this passage. Radical teaching. I mean, you know, it can make you quite uncomfortable to view Satan, the serpent of Genesis, as the real creator and benefactor. You know, you have to really go, you have to move into a deeper understanding of the truth behind the mythology of the Garden of Eden to understand what's going on. Because in the offering of the apple, it was offering the path forward into evolutionary progress through the bestowal of the mind, right? It was the mental, the entire mental apparatus was being stimulated through this metaphor of the apple. And of course, this is offered by offered by Satan, but the idea being that if he hadn't offered the apple, then humanity would have stayed in this this formless, unenlightened realm that he describes here towards the end.
Francis?
Yes. I see the hand, but I want to finish.
Yeah, hold on a minute, though. I just wanted to tell you, because I think it's appropriate for what you're talking about. Anne Veronica says, Ophiomorphus has the form of a snake.
Right. And, you know, as we know, Satan appeared in that form, and the snake is very often depicted as a form of the intelligence, as the active intelligent realm. So let's go ahead and take hands.
Okay. Ariana, go ahead, please.
Oh, this is so rich. Okay, so I'm going to try to be succinct. First of all, I just want to say this creation myth of Adam and Eve, it's such a big loss to humanity that it's interpreted concretely. It's really a shame. But so we can see, I just want to make some comments. We can see in Michelangelo's painting that's so beautiful on the Vatican ceiling, it's clearly... the serpent is wrapped around the tree, and we can see how the tree is like a spinal cord in the mind, as it is the sword of Asclepius. You know, we see the kundalini rising up in consciousness. But and we understand the importance of the tree of good and evil as the necessity to learn discrimination, because when people cannot discriminate, they're just... I'm not able to lead a life that is either of value or moral. It's sort of like a dog that hasn't been trained. So they don't have their own mooring. But what I wanted to add to that is that, you know, and then in the Hebrew Bible, it says that only God can judge. And the issue for those of us who do have a lot of discrimination, the tendency is to be very judgmental when we have developed the mind and the emotions are not at a similar level of development. There's a certain cruelty to it. And we can see that conscience is more, conscience, not consciousness, conscience is more equated with the heart. So the thing that I just wanted to add, which is different from your interpretation, which was very, very helpful to me, it's maybe additive, let us just say.
Yeah.
Is that my teacher, deceased teacher, Benjamin Crum, he said that the meaning behind this myth esoterically is the danger of eating of the apple is actually that we become possessed by knowledge. And yeah, so this sums up the issue for everyone, no offense, in this room, that we can pontificate on these ideas and we don't apply them, or we are always searching, pursuing the next tidbit of knowledge, and we're not going inward and finding our own inner authority and working on our consciousness.
Absolutely. Well said. Yeah, some really good points made. And yeah, so there is a grain of truth that if you take mind low and develop lower mind to the ultimate degree, it is the eventual pathway into what's called the eighth sphere. And the reason is that you literally, you build a shell around yourself that can't be penetrated, and it cuts off influence to the soul. But the normal development offered by, you know, the snake in the garden, who was Satan, was the path forward. But in the development of the mind is a temporary shutting off of the higher influence. And until one develops mind and then returns to the threshold and makes contact with the soul. But now as a self-conscious individual, and that's the route that is suggested and opened up by what she hears called Satan. Also, you could replace that with Lucifer or even Prometheus. It's the path of the fire of mind that's given by the Manasaputras. Next up, anybody?
Vivian says the tree of life, is that the Kabbalah with its 10 Sephiroth?
The Tree of Life is indeed that, and it's own. You have there the kind of Garden of Eden in the higher three Sephiroth, and some say the middle, sometimes not just shown Sephiroth. And then the pathway out of and back into the garden is described through the channels that connect the different Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. Anyone else?
James had his hand up, but then he took it down. Did you have a question, James?
You pretty much answered it, but I guess I want to observe that for decades, words and ideas, you know, triggered that little spark of recognition or something like Elohim, the books of the Bible that are heretical and not in it, things like that.
There are clues.
Gnostic. And so this is really pulling together a whole bunch of them. And I think for the first time, it's making sense of the Genesis eating the apple. It's like, wow. So this is a great lesson. Thank you.
Yeah, the secret doctrine is terrific for that kind of thing. You know, it can be uncomfortable when she says something like to view Satan as the real creator and benefactor. But, you know, you've already jumped in the pool, so you might as well find out what she means and, you know, realize that it's the harbinger of light is that which is brought through mind and through the eventual elevation of mind to higher mind, you know. There's no other way. Yeah.
Well, and none of that scares me. The only thing that's ever scared me is the Christianity dropping the hammer and talking about, like, it always bothered me. Why did you put the tree in Eden and say, don't eat of the fruit? Unless that was some kind of sadistic, you know, patriarchal way of doing things. So now...
Yeah, you make a really good point, which is that that's where the tree belongs. And this whole series of events is exactly what's supposed to have happened. It's the interpretation of that, you know, as falling into sin and, you know, literally having no way back except for making a deal with Christ through John 3:16, you know. In other words, it's not about self-determined evolution. It's about making a pact with the church, you know. So yeah, that was the distortion.
Right. So this is just so much relief, you know, the feeling of the last puzzle piece going in and saying, yeah, now I know why I always felt that biblical Christian interpretation was not very meaningful.
Thanks, James. Okay, let's take a look at MPH's commentary on verse 5, which is the verse we've been studying. Could we get a reader just for the column here on the right?
Mariana, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. Okay, so... the fourth round of every chain, can you hear me?
Yes.
The fourth round of every chain is that of greatest destiny. At that time, the sparks individualized from the body of the Logos must assume their fourth rate of consciousness. In the case of our chain of globes, the fourth round was the beginning of human life as we know it today. Some of the spiritual globes of light, which we call spirits, refused to come in, and upon them was pronounced a curse. The curse was the reaction of the law upon those who refused to obey it. They became the red men who were born in the fourth race, which we know as the Atlanteans. and were the most warlike and destructive of all nations.
Thank you. Okay, so the red men here described are the half-animal men earlier discussed, which the old commentary describes in volume two as, quote, "There were blue and red-faced animal men, even in later times, not from actual intercourse between the human and animal species, but by descent." And still another passage mentions red-haired, swarthy men going on all fours who bend and unbend, stand erect and fall on their hands again, who speak as their forefathers and run on their hands as their giant foremothers. So by they became the red men. MPH means that the Manasaputras, who refused to overshadow the early third root race, became karmically responsible for the anthropoids that resulted from the crossbreeding between animal man and animals. And because the Manasaputra in part incarnates with the personality that those solar angels send forth, then they were literally in certain aspects trapped within the forms of these of this unintended result, which is these half animal, half human types. And well, we read before in the interim chapter about how that they have gone into a you could call it a special learning environment until the next globe, I think it was, wherein they will be reintroduced into the incarnated human kingdom, and then take their position among human beings and continue to progress. So it's quite interesting that the these Manasaputras, who, you know, refused because they didn't feel like the form had yet been was yet ready, were then became karmically responsible for the product of their lack of overshadowing. It's quite interesting. This is MPH. You know, I also do a webinar series on the secret teachings of all ages, which is, you know, one of his greatest writings. And he did this particular issue of the manuscript series on the stanzas of Zand. He gives us just this little brief reflection on each verse in All the Secret Doctrine, which is we've found over the years to be very insightful, right? So, and I think this was, you know, his language is different than HPB's, and he looks, he has his own way of interpreting them. For here, for instance, here he says, at that time, the sparks individualized from the body of the Logos. That's, you know, another way of saying these, the jivas that are the sparks of life in each of us, must assume their quote unquote fourth rate of consciousness. So they enter this fourth cycle, which is the midway point, right? Which is that balance between spirit and matter. He has some very interesting ways of looking at things. Questions?
James, please go ahead.
Well, the way it says here, we know that as the Atlanteans and were the most warlike and destructive, I read something this year that suggested, outside of these teachings, that the Atlanteans were very cruel and tortured people, and that them and their victims became Nazis and Jews during World War II and changed, you know, flipped sides. Do you know of any relation like that, karmically?
Well, all I'm going to do is just point you to where DK develops this theme, and it's in externalization of the hierarchy. It's a really good place to read about this, but I'm not going to speculate on, you know, Atlanteans becoming Nazis, etc. It's entirely possible. The Dark Brotherhood saw an opportunity, and you know, I don't want to go in this direction of this conversation at this point, if you don't mind, you know, because there's a lot of subject matter around the this idea of those Manas Putras who refuse to create. I'd like to stick with that. But yeah, so thoughts or questions?
Keely, a soul voice says, is it possible to give the clear definition of overshadowing in this context, please?
Well, you know, this question was asked in a recent webinar, and we substituted overshadowing for overlighting, and it seemed to be, you know, a more apropos word for the what happens, which is that the in this context, the Manasa Putras literally make possible even the development of lower mind, right? The as far as animal man goes without itself, without this influence, is the development of a kind of instinct, and a cunning that comes with that instinct. But there's no real development of the thinking faculty. All of that comes through and as a result of the overshadowing of the Manasa Putras. And most of the period that's spent under that influence is development of lower mind. It's only in the last stages and for a relatively short period that the illumination of the higher mind, that the higher mind begins to illuminate lower mind, and that actual conscious reconnection with the soul aspect is made, and then soul infusion takes place, which is complete at the third initiation. But that period is relatively short. You know, for those who were overshadowed in Lemurian times, that's not the only group, but that's, you know, it's been between 18 and 21 million years of this influence, and there's still a whole lot of us that are not yet you know, truly soul infused. You know, it's quite a few of us, in fact only a tiny percent have finished that journey, you know. So the gray part of the path is in the development of lower mind under the influence.
You were bitten by a venomous spider. So what he's saying, and obviously usually that's very, very dangerous, which it wasn't. He's saying that that tick, because I saw the tick, it was a tick. It was a red tick like you saw.
Oh gosh, I didn't hear much of that. Maybe you could reconfigure your microphone and try again. I couldn't.
Yeah, we're getting some interference, Ariana. I don't know. Were you talking to us or were you talking to somebody else? Because we could hear multiple voices and we have several hands.
Oh, I'm so sorry. No, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. I'm not talking.
Oh,
I'm
sorry.
A meeting. Okay. I'm sorry. So sorry. Please forgive me.
No, that's fine. Don't worry. Don't worry.
Okay.
Just get in the habit of, as soon as you finish talking after we call on you, just hit your microphone, your off button, and that takes care of this, you know. And if you don't, BL will, but, you know, that does happen, so not a problem. Okay, let's go through the hands.
Okay. All right, and then we have a couple more comments. Go ahead, please, Vivian.
I just wanted to say that I think this is such an incredibly vast and complicated subject.
It is.
I even find that this text that we have on our screens now from Manly P. Hall in a way contradicts what we read just a little moment ago.
How so?
How so? I mean, you, the language he uses, like a curse, and they became red men, and the curse was the reaction of the law upon those who refused to obey it. And yet, previously, we were just saying that actually those who refused to obey were sacrificing, you know, we're doing a favor. I get all the words wrong. And I feel, I think it's so difficult. And I think the extremely profound way that you are going into this, that Michael Robbins went into all of this, is so important, because with this information becoming available much more widely, people can get very confused.
Yeah, they sure can. I was one of those people. I spent a long time on this trying to get an overview that would include both of the points of view that you just described, which is how can there be a curse when at the same time, you know, the this description holds, you know, which is that they were actually a self-sacrifice for the benefit of humanity. I think a lot of the apparent opposition of these two points of view is in the language, as Scott suggested, right? That certainly this high group of Manasaputras knew what they were doing when they chose to wait, or possibly never, overshadow. They knew that the price they would pay. Maybe they didn't foresee the mating of the animal and the human kingdom, but there certainly was the danger of that. You know, once man became a physical being, literally on the physical plane, you know, that there would be that danger, because there would be no consciousness aspect that would prevent that necessarily from happening. So you could say that there were negative results to their positive choice, you know. You know, every little piece of new information on this is useful, because it will help clarify the picture. Another hand?
Yes, Helios Soul Voice, please go ahead.
I think Vivian just really described what was my question. I'm on the same kind of like topic of the question, and it's interesting would be to find the most comprehensive and the most correct opinion on this. Maybe it doesn't even exist, I don't know. This is probably debatable, and I think I rest my case. Thank you.
And when you find that source, you know, bring it forward, because it'd be interesting to look at. HVB is one of the great sources for this kind of thing, you know. She can be difficult to interpret, but if you stay at it, and you can get a lot of insight into areas that are not even approached by many people, you know, by many authors. I feel that it is possible for both the effects, the results of the decision to not overshadow, and the rightness of that decision to coexist. You know, the negative results and the fact that it was still a right decision, they clearly must coexist, you know, because that's the information we're given. You know, the wrong interpretation is to imagine that they were, what did it say? They had selfish feelings, and therefore, you know, didn't want to sully themselves, you know, so to speak. I think that's a very exoteric interpretation of it. So, you know, that's where we are at this point in developing this theme.
Thank you, Donald, very much. I just really having a hard time to believe that Manasabudras were cursed. And would that also would be another karmic consequences to those who curse them and for them being cursed until they kind of mitigate that. And that is another story. But that's difficult to imagine. I'm so sorry. You know.
No problem. No, first of all, you know, in the secret teachings, you never have some kind of great personal god that does the cursing. That's not part of this thing. So the curse would be in going against the dominant law of the time. The curse, you could say, would be self-arising out of the fact that these beings chose to go against the involutional flow of the time and not overshadow. It wouldn't be pronounced on them, you know. They just have to deal with the consequences of their choice, and that would be the curse. Yes, I see Tom's hand up.
Yeah, before we go to Tom, Charlie has a comment. He says, does it relate at all that the shadow is sometimes in the secret doctrine related to etheric fields?
Let me look at this. Does it relate at all that shadow sometimes does what relate at all to this? I'm not sure.
Overshadowing. Oh, I think he means overshadowing.
Overshadowing. I think it's a term that suggests a hidden influence. And in this case, the hidden influence of the soul, which is eventually the saving grace of the personality. I don't think it has to do with specifically to do with the etheric in this case. Okay.
And then Tom, please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I think Francis, you just said what I wanted to say. It's very logical because we tend to think in the way that all is planned very strictly. And if somebody doesn't follow that plan, then he is bad and he must have bad consequences. But it doesn't work like that. The plan is flexible and all agents have kind of free will in that respect. That's why we have the karmic law that says that however good you are, however your purpose is, it will have effects.
Yeah.
So if we just clean the text from our thinking of the good guys and the bad guys, it all makes very much sense.
Yeah, it adds a surprising complexity because you wouldn't expect this, you know, that, you know, like who was it that was saying, you know, how can Manasaputras be cursed? You know, well, it's a symbolic language that, you know, that idea. It's there is no one doing the cursing. But the very fact of that two strains of development could happen concurrently, you know, is a complexity that's sort of unexpected. Okay. Question?
And then we have a couple of hands, but first, Yvonne says Christ overshadowed Jesus.
Right.
And she says he wasn't his etheric body.
Oh, yeah, right. Exactly, yeah. Okay, next.
Right, Ariana, your hand was up.
Is that for me, Ariana?
Yes.
Sorry for the last commotion. And I'll turn, I'll make sure it's off afterwards. Just a couple thoughts. So when we think about some avatar or a bodhisattva staying behind and being on this planet, this is also describing that something chooses to, out of, you know, some kind of higher law. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing people have mentioned in the chat about Christ overshadowing Jesus. And I think that's a really important point because people don't distinguish those two beings. They don't distinguish the Christ and Jesus. They, you know, in the New Age, they think of it as the cosmic Christ or consciousness of a being. And so there's the Christ consciousness, which is partially true, but I think it's really important to understand that these are two different beings.
Yeah.
The Christ is the world teacher for humanity in a certain cycle. His name is Maitreya for this period. And Maitreya was there the last 3 years. And what the overshadowing process is that both the Christ, Maitreya, and Jesus shared the same body. And Jesus was aware moment to moment the thoughts of the Christ. They were in constant communication. And that can happen. You know, supposedly Benjamin Krem did that with his own master. And it's a specific process. It is not symbolic. So that's what I'm wanting to say.
Yes, I totally agree with you. It's some really good observations that, you know, the if it was appropriate for the Christ, who is that unnamed being holding the office of the Christ, to actually incarnate, you know, in Jerusalem, that would have been the way it unfolded. But the energetic necessary involved both of them. And so the overshadowing was the most appropriate form for the avatar to take. I think it's always true. I think that the avatar always comes through the form of the lesser and is overshadowed by the greater. One of the reasons being that at a certain initiation, you can no longer incarnate. You just simply can't get here from there anymore. And so the method then becomes overshadowing. Okay, next.
And then James, go ahead, please.
I know that most of my questions are pretty giant, so I hope you've gotten a sense that I don't expect much of an answer, you know, very small, or, you know, we can file it for later. But this thing that I'm going to mention is my biggest blockage to the path. And I'm sure I've spent years avoiding it, avoiding the path because of it. So, and I realize many people don't have this problem, but all I want to do when I get into these rather intricate ideas is I just want to go back to the monad, you know, and be one with it. And so the whole involutionary cycle seems painful and almost like punishment. And then the whole evolutionary cycle of going back seems like so much to bear. Is that really just because I'm sort of at the cusp between the two and it feels like a long, long process? And I just want to go right back to, I want to go home and I don't want to deal with all this. So that's why it's been difficult for me.
Yeah. Joe Campbell quotes a song that one of his roommates in college made up, which was "Let's Dance with Zarathustra Like We Used To," you know, which is, yeah, we all pine to be, you know, pure holy beings, but we're excuse me, I swallowed a bit of water here. We're on that cusp, you could say. It's really a threshold between the light and the dark, ongoing until we take the fourth initiation, because the dweller on the threshold develops and we are aware of the angel of the presence, and that directs the nature of our consciousness. That duality directs the nature of our consciousness until we're finally at the fourth initiation, freed from the personality sheath, and we assume the level of consciousness of the soul, and we advance or are literally liberated onto the Buddhic plane. And that's all I'm going to say, because I want to stay with this subject matter. Okay. Anybody else?
No, I think we're caught up right now.
All right. So next up, verse 6, the curse is pronounced. They will be born in the fourth race, suffer and cause suffering. Wait a minute. Yeah. This is the first war. So could we get a reader for the commentary on part A, which references the statement, the curse is pronounced? Reader, please.
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
I can. Is it your intent, Francis, to skip the rest of the five?
There's the rest of five.
There's like four more pages of five. Stanza five.
So I did skip some, but I don't know about four pages.
Well, yeah.
Okay, here's what I'll do. I'll review after class. I'll review what I skipped. I mean, it's always possible. Let me look at the page numbers here. So we're at 192, stanza. are you reading on here? You can read the pages to on the right-hand side rather than what I've suggested. Let me look here real quick. We'll figure this out. Okay, I've got a few things going that I got to figure out. Hang on. All right, hold on. Oh, geez. All right, so this 192. See, so the holy use, which is what you see here. You see on the. The holy use, here I'll do it with my cursor instead of my finger. The holy use, which is described here, is also shown here, right? And then we have this, the last paragraph down here, and that's the end of verse five.
Well, I've got 4.5 to 5 pages more before it goes to stanza six.
You are working out of the apocryphal edition, isn't that correct?
I'm on page 243 of the expanded edition.
Yeah, this is indeed.
You can check that out later, but
that's interesting. That's interesting. That's the 5-volume edition, isn't it? All kidding aside.
Yes. Yeah. And 6 is the index.
Okay. So, which volume of the 5-volume is that in?
Volume 1, page 243 is where
volume 1, page 233. Okay.
243.
Good. So, now you can see that according to the 2-volume edition that came out in 1888, which is represented on the right side, that we are at the end right here. But I will look at that if there's.
I think. Now wait a minute. Oh, that's weird. Well, let's go forward with what you got planned here.
Well, yeah. Since I don't have anything to go on, we'll have to.
Yeah, okay, let's go.
Yeah, but I will take a look, and you know, especially because this is such a it is difficult material, you know, and you do have these two streams of development that seem to be oppositional.
And my book is, maybe it's the problem here, it's strange, so never mind, let's go on.
Okay. So we are on verse 6, which reads, it's another shorty. Curse is pronounced, he will be born in the fourth race, suffer and cause suffering. This is the first war. So a reader, and you are the reader.
That's me. Okay. A, it is a universal tradition that before this physiological fall, propagation of one's kind, whether human or animal, took place through the will of the creators or of their progeny. It was the fall of spirit into generation, not the fall of mortal man. It has already been stated that to become a self-conscious spirit, the latter must pass through every cycle of being, culminating in its highest point on earth in man.
Thank you. So first, it is a universal tradition that before the physiological fall, propagation of one's own kind, whether human or animal, took place through the will of the creators or of their progeny, right? So This was the, you know, we read about this a lot in the interim chapter, where not Manasseh but Jews, but this particular group of Dhyani Chohans would project their shadows, you could say, of themselves. And in this case, shadow is the correct term, because they would be just the physical aspects projected into lower levels that were designed to allow the shell, the body aspect, the threefold form aspect of human beings to develop, right? So that was, that is what he means by the will of the creators or of their progeny, right? And the physiological fall happened in the third root race, when the fourth subrace of the Lemurian race actually began to propagate as we do today. So let me look at my notes here. A quote unquote universal tradition suggests that the method of propagation through the use of the will was used throughout the solar system, universal, right? And even possibly throughout the cosmos. This method involves a lunar lord projecting its double, or chahaya, into denser matter of substance. The physiological fall, as I just said, references physical procreation, which began in the second half of the third root race, which is the Lemurian root race. Okay, and next. It was the fall of spirit into generation, not the fall of mortal man. It has already been stated that to become a self-conscious spirit, the latter must pass through every cycle of being, culminating in its highest point on earth in man. So we talked about this a little bit. There are no shortcuts, right? Every stage must be experienced and incorporated into one's conscious awareness. This statement also points out a major difference between traditional Christianity, which believes that the fall brought on by Eve's acquiescence to the devil in the Garden of Eden was a fall into sin, and the theosophical perspective, which recognizes that the fall into generation and the passing through every cycle of being is the only way that the second principle, consciousness, can be developed. With sin or error and its karmic repercussions, one of the primary means by which this consciousness leads humanity into soul awareness. You have to make the errors are corrected through karma, and then you learn yet another lesson that takes you forward on the path, right? You have this fundamental, I think a great tragedy in the way that this, the idea of the fall has been taught. Okay, next up.
Francis?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that it's not only the way of the fall. That is a primary example, but the over thousands of years, religions have been cherry-picked to emphasize one thing to the exclusion of everything else, and then reimagined and repurposed to fit a specific need. And, you know, that's what Nikkei talks about the new world religion that will come out, because, you know, everybody's got a little tiny piece of the right puzzle. They're just not putting the thing together right. And it's caused so much strife. I mean, who would ever think you would have religious war in the same sentence? It just doesn't equate. But anyway, like I said, this is a primary example of how how these ancient teachings that really did have the meat of it have been bastardized unforgivably.
Yeah, and yet understandably, because you know, the religion of any given time can't transcend the consciousness of that time, you know. So you had, you know, the church wanted to be a very powerful entity, and so as you know, your word was cherry picked, you know, it cherry picked those parts of the testaments that would best forward its agenda. And they left out teachings such as reincarnation and the idea that we are responsible for our own becoming, you know. And also, maybe most importantly, that the real purpose of the Christ is the Christ principle, the soul principle, rather than Jesus who died on a cross a long time ago. You know, so it's but it was following the agenda, an agenda in order to consolidate power that happened at the time, you know. And I think that kind of fall, an actual fall, has happened in many of the religions. You know, they start pure or near pure. You know, you could say they access the idea, the realm of idea, and they create an ideal. But then by the time buildings start to be constructed and commentaries on the original books are written, you're moving into the Rococo period, out of the classic period, you know. And sometimes what survives is really useful. Like, I think Buddhism is mostly right on, you know, even though, you know, you can make comments about their rigid seventh ray sort of ceremonialism or whatever, but it's much closer, I think, in many ways than, say, Christianity, which has really become the shadow of the original teachings in so many ways. And yet, you have many who practice that religion who are committed to the good. So, you know, that's just kind of where we are. And where we are also is out of time. So,
Okay. I just want to say, first off, Charlie says, one can say religions used as priests to control followers.
Yeah, that's the phase I was just describing. But it's not the only thing. You know, the original impetus is invariably inspired. I mean, who knows of a religion that didn't have some high avatar that inspired it? You know, it's the second stage, or even the third stage, where that self-interest comes in. So, yeah. Okay.
But thanks. All right.
Enjoyed this. Do you want to announce dates?
Yes. The next webinar is going to be the Treatise on Cosmic Fire on the 22nd, so this coming Friday. And the next Secret Teaching of All Ages is 7 January. The next Secret Doctrine is 21 January. And word got out, Francis.
Oh, no.
Everybody unmute.
Oh, no. It'll be a cacophony.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
And many, many more.
That's the epitome of the thought that counts.
That was a a collective Zoom event. And it's why we mute ourselves. But you know, it's really is the thought that counts. Thank you all so much. I appreciate it.
Yvonne should get a lot of credit. Yvonne should get the credit. She wrangled
okay,
it.
Okay, Yvonne, I'll
Anne blabbed and Yvonne ran with it.
It's true. It's true. I did blab.
Okay, well, I'll get even with you both later. So
you do so much for us. Thank you.
Much love, Francis.
Well, I want to say that, you know, this is really a wonderful thing for me in my life to be able to host these webinars. So I appreciate you all very much. And I really appreciate when you involve yourself like you did today. That was just a terrific exchange. And so I appreciate that very much. So, okay, until next time, which is Friday, the 22nd.
Right. And for me, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, because I won't see you. And happy holidays to everybody else, because I won't see you until the first of the year. So goodbye, everybody.
Bye, BL. Bye. Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you, BL.